It's Morning Edition on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Paula Coleman. It's an election year for the ages. Political animosity divides the government. There is a battle over the nation's economic future, and tension between the state and federal power nearly boils into armed conflict. The year is not 2016, but 1832. Andrew Jackson was the man in the White House, and it was a volatile year of his presidency. The University of Tennessee's Jackson Papers Project has just released a volume covering 1832, and Jackson Papers director Daniel Feller spoke with WUOT's Brandon Hollingsworth.
I would say that Jackson, if anything, was revived in 32. I'm not sure he would say this, but as a historian looking in it, 32 is really the year that Jackson hit his stride. 1831 was a very ugly and lurid year, dominated by rather sordid personal feuds within the administration and between the administration and its opponents, between Jackson and his own vice president, Calhoun, between cabinet members. 1832 is much more policy year. It was the year that Jackson stood for and won resoundingly re-election. It was the year that he delivered his veto of the recharter of the Bank of the United States, which was the signature document of his whole presidency. And it was the year when he grappled with nullification in South Carolina. That story went on into 1833. But again, I'm not sure Jackson would say this, but as a historian, you can see Jackson finding better things to get exercised about than he had in 1831. Jackson famously said at one point to one of his confidants, "I was born for a storm and a calm does not suit me." And when there wasn't a storm, Jackson had to create a storm. And sometimes the storms that he self-created were rather sordid. In 1832, there were real storms. There were real monsters to slay. He didn't have to go out and invent new ones. And the Bank of the United States, you might say, was a worthy fight over a substantive issue. It wasn't just personality.
I definitely want to ask about this battle of the Bank of the United States, which may seem like one of those arcane things from our American history textbooks, if we remember from grade school. But there was a serious debate, as there is now, about the role of the government in the nation's economy and monetary policies. Jackson, as a rule, hated the Bank of the United States. He didn't like the idea of centralized control of the bank. The bank's charter was coming up for renewal, so the time was ripe to have this great debate about what role the Bank of the United States was going to play, and Jackson made it completely clear where he stood on that.
Exactly. Jackson had actually made it clear as early as 1829 in his first three messages to Congress in 1829, 30, 31. He said the bank issue was coming up, and I am opposed to recharter. He didn't dig himself in irrevocably, but he had staked out a position. As Jackson saw it, what was at stake was much more than the arcane details of banking, and they are arcane up until the point where they become essential to everyone. And I think we saw some of that a few years ago. The banking system is technical and arcane and rather boring as long as it works. Then when all of a sudden it doesn't work,
it becomes deeply effective to a lot of people.
That's right. And it affects not only people's bank accounts, but really their whole way of life. As Jackson saw it, the Bank of the United States was an unregulated, tremendously powerful, and it was, institution that was not actually part of the government. It was, in fact, a privately owned bank that paid dividends to its stockholders and yet was doing essential business for the government in return for, and these were in the words of its charter, exclusive privileges. And as Jackson saw it, that was, first, it was economically dangerous because there was a real question, and it was a practical question. Was the Bank of the United States conducting itself for the interests of its stockholders or for the interests of the people of the United States? And as Jackson saw it, as Jackson's supporters saw, well, exactly what defined American democracy was that it was a government by and for everybody, you and me, not merely the aristocracy. Mm. And when you have the government granting a charter, an act of incorporation, a special act of incorporation, to one group of stockholders, giving them tremendous economic and political power, that's a threat to the whole American way of life, at least as Jackson saw it.
In our previous conversations, you have mentioned that political disputes for Jackson became personal with alarming frequency. He took things like that very personally, and so what might have been an economic or a philosophical dispute in any other administration for Jackson was deeply personal. How did he look at the bank battle itself, that policy fight?
Jackson did personalize the dispute with the Bank of the United States and with its president, Nicholas Biddle of Philadelphia, who was part of the American well-educated upper class.
What we might call the elites today.
What we might call the elites, what Jackson would have called the aristocracy or the perfumed aristocracy. Jackson regarded him as something of a fop. And yet, I would say, based upon the documents that we're bringing to light in these volumes, the policy dispute in this case came first and the personalization came afterwards. It was not, though some historians have said it was, that Jackson took a dislike to Biddle and decided to destroy the bank. His reasons for wanting to destroy the bank, whether or not you think they were good reasons, had to do with the nature of the bank and not with Biddle. I would say the same thing about the other big national issue that shows up in the 1832 documents, and that's the nullification crisis. And you often hear that Jackson just hated John C. Calhoun, and so he was going to go down and hang all the nullifiers. If you actually look at what Jackson did and what Jackson said, it wasn't about Calhoun at all. Jackson had a rather surprisingly sophisticated understanding of the constitutional issues at stake. And he was the very opposite of trigger happy. And he made very careful and cautious plans to handle the nullification crisis through legal mechanisms, through a prudent readiness to use force in self-defense, none of which had anything to do with hanging Calhoun. The hanging Calhoun is kind of, you know, it's loose parlor talk. That's not really what it was about.
I want to focus, of course, on the nullification crisis, which, as you mentioned, was another of the huge issues, national issues, that faced the Jackson administration in this year of 1832. Jackson won re-election in November of that year, but it was just the very next month. In December, the issue came up whether we're going to send federal troops into South Carolina. What is going to happen? People were thinking this might tip into armed conflict. We know now, of course, that it didn't, but it also was not the end of the nullification issue and states' rights versus federal authority. How was Jackson talking about that? He had kind of a surprising view. He was very union first for a guy of his era.
Jackson was at first a fervent unionist nationalist. He identified himself really with the United States. He was patriotic to the bone. There were some things that Jackson was, for instance, a slaveholder because of his circumstances, and he certainly had no qualms about being a slaveholder. But to, the essence of Jackson was wrapped up with the preservation of the United States. He also had a fairly sophisticated understanding of constitutional issues involved in nullification. And in the proclamation that he delivered in December 1832, he laid these out in considerable detail and very compellingly. When South Carolina nullified the protective tariff, which is what they did, Jackson responded first by asking Congress for certain enforcement measures. He asked Congress for them. He did not march an army, in fact. And while he was prepared to do that, that was the very last step. At the same time that Jackson was very carefully maneuvering military forces in a position where they would be ready to go if necessary, he was also writing letters to his unionist contacts in South Carolina, the minority there, saying, don't start anything. Don't shoot first.
Right.
We will not shoot first. If this is going to come to a fight, it is important that they start it and that they be put in the wrong. And really, that policy It's very familiar to American historians because it's exactly Abraham Lincoln's policy in a somewhat similar situation 30 years later, when Lincoln goes to great lengths to make sure that if there's going to be a war, let the secessionists start it. Now, it did not come to that, but really Jackson's planning for nullification was quite prudent and I'd even say masterful. For instance, in order to face down the South Carolinians, one of the things that he did is he contacted his friends in various states, other southern states and northern states, and said, see if you can get resolutions passed through your state legislature supporting the national government and opposing nullification, which will fortify me, but it will also help show the South Carolinians how isolated they are and will encourage them to back down. This is a political response. It's not a military response. And in fact, it was a quite effective response. At one point, the New York legislature was taking its time. And Jackson wrote to his vice president-elect, Martin Van Buren, of New York.
Who was from New York.
New York, and it said, what are you people doing there?
Yeah.
You know? Every other state in the Union is lining up and declaring itself, it's time for you to do it too, and New York eventually did.
Is there anything in these documents that lets us know how Andrew Jackson felt like he was doing as president at this halfway point through his 8 years in office? Was he saying like, yeah, I feel like I'm doing a pretty good job, or I'm doing the best I can? Or how did he evaluate his own performance?
He was quite satisfied, and even to this extent, before nullification in late 1831 and through into 1832, Jackson wrote several letters to Van Buren in which, between the lines, he was saying, look, by the beginning of my second term, the national debt will have been paid off, another thing that he was centered on.
Mm-hmm.
And we will have accommodated the tariff. That turned out not to be true. And my work will be done, and I can retire to the Hermitage. What he was suggesting was that after winning re-election in 1832 and then being vindicated and having Van Buren instead of his first vice president, Calhoun, he was going to resign. He actually thought that there was going to be nothing left for him to do, that he had accomplished everything.
That's kind of amazing hubris, really.
That is. It's also amazing because we don't think of Jackson as being the run-and-quit type. And really, it wasn't quitting. Jackson thought, my work is done. I've accomplished what I want to do. And the historians, I think, don't know about this. I've never seen any reference to it. And of course, the way Jackson approached it with Van Buren was very guarded. He never said, I'm going to resign.
Right.
But that's clearly what he meant. But then nullification came along. Jackson decided that there was still more work to be done after vetoing the bank recharter because the bank was still there and still dangerous. And once again, there was another storm for him to battle.
Before we part ways, I want to mention that this election year features some of the similar concerns that Jackson would have been worried about in his re-election bid in 1832, competing economic philosophies, questions about the boundaries of state and federal authority, a nasty presidential campaign, accusations of elitism, the us versus them. What can we draw from Jackson's time that might inform us about what's going on this year?
Well, I am reluctant to say that we should take Andrew Jackson's example. Partly because, well, there are certain recurring themes. The details are different, and the differences in the details can be important.
You telling me one time, by the way, history is made sometimes of intersecting lines, but they're not parallel
lines.
That's right.
I once said, I wouldn't recommend acting like Andrew Jackson if you're not Andrew Jackson.
You get the one shot. Yeah,
because he was a pretty, in ways that historians are still debating about, pretty...
Yeah.
Controversial figure. I do think that there were issues that came up in Jackson's time, and I won't say that looking at those and that are still around, and I won't say that looking at those tells us how to deal with them, but it does remind us that they're not the creation of yesterday. One of them that we haven't talked about is the relation of church and state. There was a cholera epidemic in 1832. And Jackson was beseeched to do something that previous presidents had done, which was to issue a proclamation calling for a national day of fasting and prayer. And actually, there was a congressional resolution asking him to do this. And Jackson rather boldly said, I'm not going to do it. And he said, this is not the province of the government to take a religious stance in this way. This is an issue we are still dealing with.
Yeah.
The banking issue, if I can bring this in, I was reading this morning my email and I get announcements of new books that are being published.
Yeah.
And one of them, just this morning, a book called Central Bank Governance and Oversight Reform. And the description of the book starts out by saying, a central bank needs authority and a sphere of independent action, but a central bank cannot become an unelected czar with a sweeping, unaccountable discretionary power. Those are words almost right out of Andrew Jackson.
Yeah. Well, everything old is new again, whether it's the election year of 2016 or the election year of 1832. Dan Feller is the executive director and editor of the Papers of Andrew Jackson Project at the University of Tennessee. The group's latest compendium of the Papers of Andrew Jackson, Volume 10, which covers the year 1832, is just out from UT Press. Dr. Feller, as always, a pleasure to have you.
A pleasure to be here.